meaningless thought. The shell appears strong, but the inside is rot. It's time to be stirred. The time is now. The winds have changed. Read the signs. No time to hide. The winds have changed.
Millennia ago, from the little cave on the tiny island of Patmos in the Aegean Sea, the heavens opened. Since then, the world has been fascinated by the cosmic upheaval brewing on the horizon of history. The upheaval is now upon us. It is within us. To some degree, it always has been. But there has been a sudden and violent shift in the affairs of the world. The winds have changed. Heaven will not be silent. Let's now join Father Anthony Bush, pastor of St. Stanislaus Kostka, the Sanctuary of the Divine Mercy in Chicago, and author of A Mother's Plea, For the Winds Have Changed. Together we can pave the way for a hopeful response to the signs of our times.
And good Monday afternoon. This is Mary Helen Fiorito. I am the Cardinal Francis George Fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Center in Washington, D.C., and the DeNicola Center for Ethics and Culture at the University of Notre Dame. I am joined, as ever, by my co-host, Loretta Frelick, criminal prosecutor extraordinaire, although now in retirement. And we're really happy to be with you on this first Monday of the Advent season.
Yes, and we are, Mary. Glory to God.
Yeah,
it's you know, and if our listeners have a moment to look up Father Mike Schmidt's Ascension Press's little 5-minute video on Advent, I think they'll find it really helpful in getting ready for Advent.
Yeah, well, there's so many good resources available. In fact, I just subscribed to the Hallow app.
I did because they're
doing a daily 10-minute reflection with the cast members of The Chosen.
I know, isn't that exciting?
So they were giving a 3-month free trial, and I thought, you know what, I'll try it. And I did the first one this morning, and if you don't have access to a church first thing in the morning or you can't get to daily mass, it's a really nice way to help quiet yourself, not to get caught up in all the shopping. And hopefully now that this Cyber Monday will be gone, people can really focus spiritually on preparing for the Christ child in amidst of all their other preparations. But did you have a good Thanksgiving?
Well, I had an interesting Thanksgiving, but it was filled with lots of love, Mayor. As you know, my mom fell. She broke her hip.
Yeah.
So she was in the hospital, and I'm telling you, the nurses and the doctors at Rush Oak Park are phenomenal.
Oh, terrific.
They were so loving, so giving, so caring. But I have to tell you, God answered every prayer. We got into the rehab center we needed. But I have to tell, I want to give a little shout out to a friend of mine, Kitty McSorley.
Mm-hmm.
She and her brother Matthew Shanahan made Thanksgiving dinner for my whole family.
Oh, wasn't that thoughtful?
And, you know, my brother and his kids and myself and my mom. And I didn't get home from the hospital, the rehab center. My mom got transferred that day. But, Mary, when I took a bite out of that Thanksgiving, honest to God, it just tasted like love.
Oh, that's beautiful.
It really, I mean,
there's nothing like when people send you food.
Oh, my gosh.
It really is. And I used to wonder, you know, why, like, my mother would make a casserole if somebody lost a spouse, lost a parent, you know. And then when my sister died a couple of months ago, the food that showed up, you know, for the whole week of the funeral and stuff, it was wonderful. I had, you know, I was so caught up with the preparations for the funeral and the wake. And it was nice not to have to worry about that. So that is, you know, that is a real gift of love is to me, especially on a holiday.
Yes. And she's one of 10. She could have been any number of places.
Right.
She chose to cook for us.
Oh, God bless her.
How about you? How was your Thanksgiving?
It was nice. You know, it was the first Thanksgiving since my sister passed away. So my siblings and I got together and we hosted at my house. And it was disaster free. So, and I had a dear friend who was passing through and stayed with us for a night. And so she helped me, you know, get the linens ready and set the table. And, you know, my silverware's gone missing. So that I'm going to have to find before Christmas. But other than that, the turkey turned out fairly well. And, you know, we have to cook for both gluten and gluten-free in our house. And so keeping those things separate is always a little bit of a challenge. But it was nice. And we had a really nice meal. And, you know, it was good. It was good to just kind of be by ourselves as a family.
Because
it's a hard...
Absolutely.
You know...
Absolutely.
Yeah, the first of all those things, everyone tells you the first Christmas is hard, the first birthday, the first. So we got through the first Thanksgiving and were able to say what we were thankful for. And even amidst our sorrow, we had a lot to be thankful for. So
right.
It was very good. So anyway.
Well, yeah. It's funny that you mentioned the being thankful for, because I have a family that has nothing but blessing. And my little nephew made these like feathers, and he colored them.
Uh-huh.
And so, we put everybody's name on them that was, you know, going to be around the table. My nephew picked up his feather and says to me, "If you think I'm writing on this, what I'm thankful for."
You've had it. I'm not doing it. Yeah, we didn't do that this year. We in past years when the kids were small, we did that.
Right.
But yeah, that's my eldest daughter was home from college just for 48 hours. I mean, just trying to find her. She had classes on Wednesday, the day before Thanksgiving.
Gosh.
They had classes. They had a full day of school, so she couldn't. She could have left at midnight on Wednesday, but I didn't feel like that was safe. And she said, "I just will be too tired." And then getting into O'Hare at 5 a.m. So she left at 7 a.m. from Portland and got in at about. It was about noon she came in, so she was there for dinner and went out late Saturday night. So those were the only flights we could find for her, believe it or not. Yeah, it was crazy. And that, well, we could have found a flight on Sunday, but it would have been about $1,200. So.
Exactly. You know, a little mortgage payment.
Right, exactly. We FaceTimed with our daughter overseas, so it was nice. And then,
that's wonderful.
So my husband's side of the family at a different gathering on Saturday, so it was good. We got everybody. You know, my daughter was able to see grandma and grandpa and cousins on both sides, so that was... That was real. We don't get that every year,
no.
You know.
And the blessing of technology. I mean, we are forever saying how bad technology is, but look at the way in which it brought your family together
from
all parts and all calls.
Well, we'll count on the prayers of me and the listeners, I'm sure. I can speak for them, for your mom.
Thank you.
A hip break or fracture, not uncommon in the elderly. And but because it is, it happens, I think, frequently with older people. They've really perfected the surgery and the treatment and the rehab, which is so important.
Well, her doctor, Rocky Romano, is probably the most expert. He is so good at what he does. And I have to tell you that his generous spirit, willing to operate her on her at 8 p.m. on Friday night.
Wow.
And then it getting switched to 8 o'clock on Saturday morning. You just don't find that generous heart.
Right.
And we were blessed that he chose to do it, because I am every confident in her accelerated healing. And she is a trooper.
Well, she is. And she's a little prayer force all on her
own.
She is. So tell her she can't go anywhere, because I need her. I rely on her prayers. And so.
Well, as Mary knows, her nickname is Prayer Patrol. Whenever we have a need among our friends or family. You know, we'll get the call, not will you pray for me? Will you ask Prayer Patrol?
Yeah. Well, I always say there's no time for amateurs. I need to call Loretta's mother, you know, if there's something really wrong and really desperate. So, well.
Oh, you're funny, Mary.
Okay, now that we've hit all those important notes and prayer requests for your family and sharing our joyous Thanksgiving experiences, we are going to move on to today's guest. We are so fortunate to have with us again Professor Michael New, who is an expert on statistical information, particularly as it relates to abortion data. And we've got the new 2020 numbers for this from the CDC, the Center for Disease Control. Professor New, are you there with us?
Yep, I'm here.
Terrific, terrific. Well, thank you for coming back. You're almost at the point where, like, you get the free show mug. I think you need to come back a fourth time, and then we get you. Then you'll get a mug. But we'd have to get the mugs created first. But when we do, you'll be one of our first guests to get one, because you're now a frequent guest, and we really are grateful for you making the time. So, Professor New, there were some surprising developments in that CDC data. So I know you've written an article on this at National Review. You're very well published in this area of abortion statistics. I call you the human computer, because I don't think I've ever asked you a question that you haven't been able to immediately call to mind the precise answer to it. But talk to us a little bit about what surprised you with this CDC data.
Oh, sure. The big surprise of the data, which is good news, is that abortion numbers fell in 2020. Both the abortion rate and the overall number of abortions fell by about 2%.
Okay.
And normally that wouldn't be, you know, a big deal. But it's a good development, because we've actually seen in recent years a slight increase in the incidence of abortion. CDC data reported abortion increases in both 2018 and 2019. So the fact that numbers fell in 2020 is good news.
Yeah, well, you know, so before we get diving into the particulars of it, I know there are a lot of people who don't really think that the CDC data is worth grappling with because, if correct me if I'm wrong here, but they still don't include the numbers from California and New York. Is that correct?
They do include New York. They don't include California,
right.
And they also don't typically include Maryland or New Hampshire.
Okay.
So typically we get data from about 47 states plus Washington, D.C. I mean, the data is far from perfect, but it does tend to mirror the Guttmacher data where they do a survey of abortion facilities. So it's not worthless. I mean, there's plenty of room for improvement.
Yeah,
but
Professor, this is Loretta. Can I ask, I can understand why New York and California wouldn't put their numbers in the program, but why Maryland and New Hampshire? What causes these four states not to be included?
That's an excellent question. And basically, I'll just say, broadly speaking, the reporting requirements for abortion data are very weak. Insofar as I know, I don't believe that states or state health departments face any penalties if they refuse to report abortion data. So one thing, and this is partly on pro-lifers, we've not really prioritized stronger abortion reporting requirements historically. They're weak. Some states don't report. Some states tend to report data that we think is incomplete or doesn't contain much information. So, again, we've always had pretty weak requirements, and it is something pro-lifers are taking seriously, but historically it's not something we've really prioritized.
Yeah, that's, you know, and California being, of course, the most populous state in the country, and from what I understand, they really have an extremely high abortion rate that it would, I think, increase the number significantly. Would that be your interpretation of it as well?
Well, certainly if we include data from California, I mean, we'd see higher numbers, certainly. But keep in mind, when we're looking at the declines, we're looking at the same states from 2020 and comparing them to the same set of states from 2019. So
right.
I don't necessarily know that including California would give us an abortion increase between the 2 years. I think that, you know, we can be pretty confident of at least a slight decline between 2020 and 2019.
Okay. All right. Well, let's move on then to the, there was an increase. I'm just trying to kind of grapple with all, because there's a lot of numbers, and I'd like, if you could, to help our audience understand what it means sort of practically speaking. So between 2019 and 2020, the number of chemical abortions went up almost 20%. And why should that, I have a lot of concerns about chemical abortions, but what, from a statistical point of view and then a pro-life point of view, why should that concern us so much?
Yeah, this is something we should be concerned about. I mean, it's good news that overall abortion numbers fell, but one area of concern for pro-lifers is that in 2020, we saw a big increase in chemical abortions.
Yeah.
According to the CDC data, number of chemical abortions increased by about 17.9%, and right now, more than half of all abortions are chemical abortions.
Right, and are those statistically, calculated in the same way that surgical abortions are? I mean, are the same data kept? Okay, so someone just comes to pick
CDC
up the pills?
CDC breaks down abortions into surgical abortions and chemical abortions, and we saw an increase in chemical abortions by nearly 18%.
Okay.
And part of that was just the pandemic. I mean, 2020 was the pandemic year, and the FDA tragically changed their policy and allowed women to obtain chemical abortion drugs without an in-person medical exam.
Yeah.
So a lot of women, you know, opted for chemical abortions. You know, we know that they're dangerous, and allowing for them without an in-person medical exam even makes them even more dangerous.
Yeah, that's astounding to me.
One thing I tell listeners is that, you know, if a woman is ectopic pregnancy and she tries to obtain a chemical abortion, that can be fatal.
Oh, absolutely.
If a woman, is further along in her pregnancy than she realizes, and she tries to obtain a chemical abortion, that could have some pretty negative, serious health consequences. So, again, it's a tragic decision that was made during the pandemic. And even worse, the Biden administration, FDA, is continuing that policy.
Right
now, you know, women can still get chemical abortion drugs without an in-person medical exam. Obviously, it's fatal for unborn children, but has a lot of negative health consequences for women as well.
Well, the organization with which you're affiliated, the Charlotte Lozier Institute, You've had, Lozier had a really good study on the massive increase in the number of emergency room visits following chemical abortions. Can you speak to that at all?
Sure. That we've actually seen, that was not my study, so I mean, I don't have numbers, my figures, tips. But I do know that we saw that, you know, a big increase in emergency room visits. You know, I will say since the FDA approved the chemical abortion pill in 2000, again, this was during the Clinton administration, they kind of rushed it through. There was no hearings, there was no legislation.
Right.
It was just done by kind of fiat by the FDA. Since that time, we've had 24 deaths due to the chemical abortion pill. We've had over 1,000 hospitalizations due to the chemical abortion pill,
okay,
and nearly 4,200 adverse effects. And that's just what we know of. I mean, considering that abortion report requirements are weak, the numbers are probably higher.
So that's just
what we know of.
So since 2019, there have been 26 deaths from chemical abortion pills?
No, since 2000.
Since 2000, okay.
Yep.
And and does it also calculate the number of deaths from surgical abortions?
We have that data. I don't have it right at my fingertips.
Okay.
I know I'm the human computer.
But that is something the CDC tracks, yes?
Yeah, they do track it. And I mean, I would say that, you know, the surgical abortion numbers is, you know, again, the numbers are, you know, typically a few a year. But again, we really don't know because the reporting requirements are pretty weak.
Right.
You know, typically, if something goes wrong during an abortion, you know, an abortion, you know, doctor will take a woman to, you know, a hospital where, you know, he has a connection, and they may list something different as the cause of death.
Exactly.
I think there's a lot of cover-ups with these, you know, botched abortions. So
even
though the CDC numbers for, you know, surgical abortion deaths are low, I think that that's badly, badly underreported.
You know, I do as well. I have a, you know, and I wish we could find, as a pro-life community, a way to really get specifics with those numbers. Of course, the other side doesn't want us to know them. But I have two friends who are OBGYNs who regularly do shifts on the emergency room. And they've both told me stories about getting either that one of my friends had a 15-year-old come in. She had an incomplete abortion. She had sepsis. He was able to save her, but she could a few more hours. And he said she probably would have been an organ failure by the time she showed up. And he said, I couldn't have brought her back, but I was able to save her. Abortion clinic wouldn't return his calls. The abortion, you know, the abortionist who did the procedure wouldn't return his calls. But, you know, had she died, I'm left wondering, would her death have been attributed to sepsis and not to the abortion that caused the sepsis? That's where I think we get some of these numbers get played with a little bit.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I've even, you know, anecdotally heard some things from people who, you know, work in Washington, D.C. emergency rooms that, you know, but no one wants to speak up that abortion is such a contentious, such a polarizing issue that, you know, a lot of people who see the after effects just are reluctant to speak up about it. But again, I agree that, you know, very often some of the deaths that are caused by abortion are officially listed as something else, and that's why these, you know, death numbers could be a bit low.
Professor, this is Loretta again. In light of the numbers that you have that show how serious the consequences in chemical abortions are, is there any data as to why someone would choose a chemical abortion rather than a surgical?
I really don't have a, you know, good answer for that. I mean, I think in some cases it may be, you know, a little bit less expensive.
Okay.
There may be some women who would just prefer to obtain an abortion and go through that process in the privacy of their home or their apartment rather than a facility or a clinic. You know, again, tragically, with the, you know, FDA rules, these chemical abortion pills can be obtained through the mail. That does, in some cases, make it easier. I mean, those are some reasons I might think of.
Yeah, you know, and you know, too, Professor New, it's the psychological impact of the abortion pill, in addition to the complications that can arise, you know, physically for women. You know, when a woman's having a surgical abortion, she's not the person performing the abortion. The abortionist is. But with a chemical abortion, she's the moral agent. She is the one taking the pills. And I have, you know, priest friends who do Project Rachel work, so post-abortion healing work, who have talked about the real difference in the psychological and spiritual reaction to women who, you know, basically self-abort by taking the pills themselves, and how much more difficult it is to kind of bring them to healing. There was a woman who volunteered at the pregnancy center where both Loretta and I have been volunteers and supporters for many years, who had a chemical abortion. And, you know, as often happens, passed the baby's remains on the toilet. And she was about 11 weeks, I think. So there was a discernible sac, amniotic sac there with a discernible tiny human being. And she said, I flushed it down the toilet. She said, I flushed my own child down the toilet. And now she really makes an effort to let other women know how completely traumatizing that entire experience was. And that's, you know, you get this impression sometimes from the advertising from the abortion clinics that this is just, you know, like you said, the privacy of your home and simple and quiet and you just, you know, take care of it. But, you know, you can have very, very severe cramping and hemorrhaging. And again, to the Lozier's report on the increase in emergency room visits.
Right. Now, what about the 2022 midterms? Can you tell us what that means for pro-lifers? Everybody was expecting this big red wave and prophesying this big red wave. And yet you see hope for from the 2022 midterms, right?
Well, the 2022 midterms were a mixed bag. You know, I mean, pro-lifers did have some setbacks, but we won some victories, too. I mean, on the positive side of the ledger, you know, Republicans did win a majority of seats in the House. That will be an effective check on President Biden. So that is a positive development.
And goodbye, Nancy
Pelosi. Absolutely. Yeah, Nancy Pelosi is the longer speaker.
She
and I think
is going to go home and take care of Paul.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's a great reason for
the House. Yeah. But you know, what do you think of the case? I know that our opponents on this issue have really attempted to make much of the number of young women who came out and voted in very significant races. But I also know, for example, that Democratic advertising for abortion alone, they spent more than the entire advertising budget of McDonald's worldwide in a year. So they spent $320 million in abortion advertising. What impact do you think... you know, just as someone who's so as involved as you are and who reads all the studies, what impact do you think that what were often very misleading and deceptive ads, what impact do you think they may have had on the outcomes?
I think that, you know, it has a large impact. I mean, that, you know, in modern politics, you know, campaigning is expensive, TV ads are expensive, and unfortunately our opponents are a big financial advantage over us very often, and they really did spend, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars on, you know, these abortion-focused ads. That said, you know, they threw their best punch, but you know what? They didn't score, you know, the big victories in many cases they thought they would. Again, you know, Republicans did win a majority of seats in the House of Representatives. Many pro-life governors, and I think this is a key point for pro-lifers, many pro-life governors who signed very strong pro-life bills, you know, didn't hide from the abortion issue, faced strong, you know, well-financed opponents, won by big margins. You know, Greg Abbott was reelected by more than 10 percentage points in Texas.
Yes.
Brian Kemp was reelected by a sound margin in Georgia. Mike DeWine was reelected by a very large margin, I think more than 20 points in Ohio. Ron DeSantis won a big reelection victory in Florida. So you had a lot of very good Republican governors signed very solid, strong pro-life bills. I mean, in Ohio, there's a heartbeat bill. In Georgia, there's a heartbeat bill. Texas, you know, unborn children are protected, you know, throughout gestation. All these governors won, you know, by pretty solid margins. So, you know, the abortion issue, you know, didn't damage, I think, you know, pro-life candidates the way some have argued. You know, I think that the elections do show that when people do sign strong pro-life laws and don't hide from the issue and make good arguments, you know, people are often receptive.
Right. And, you know, what I thought was really interesting was that Republican candidates who kind of ran away for the abortion issue. And we saw this here in Illinois with Darren Bailey, who was our nominee, who I really like. I like him. I know him and his wife. I consider them friends. I think they are very good people. But I think his campaign made a very significant tactical error in not going after J.B. Pritzker for his extremism. And Pritzker's a billionaire, and he spent like a billionaire. You could not look at any YouTube video without seeing an ad from J.B. Pritzker about abortion. You just couldn't. It was everywhere.
But yet, Mary, you bring up the issue of J.B. Pritzker and running those abortion ads. The issue in Illinois, it is settled in so many ways in that you can obtain an abortion up to the day you give birth.
Well, yeah, that's... Yeah.
And now comes the next step,
right,
which is scary.
Yeah.
But what I found so disingenuous by the Democratic Party was the ads that were, I mean, I even heard the one where there's a policeman at the door coming to arrest a woman at her dinner table for having an abortion.
I mean, outright lie.
That was an outright lie, but it was fear-mongering in the worst way. And what was so shocking was abortion was not an issue in Illinois campaign
and
this year.
And that's as much as the Republican candidate would say, was that, you know, there wouldn't be anything he could do if he wanted to. But he didn't go after him on the extremism of repealing parental notice and of taxpayer-funded abortions, which, of course, now we have here. So I think there was some vulnerability there that he did not capitalize on. And if he had not run away from the issue, he may have been able to at least come significantly closer. Michael, I'm not sure if you're aware of this, but the AP, the Associated Press, called the race for Pritzker at 7:02 p.m. People were still in line waiting to vote, and they called it. They called it like it was never in question that Darren Bailey was going to lose.
Well, yeah, that's, you know, you think you should at least let people vote before you make a stupid announcement. That's I don't really think much of the media, but good grief, you know, you think you at least wait till the votes are in before you declare a winner.
Right, exactly. And it just was so kind of, you know, and Darren Bailey actually did very well in the first debate. He floundered a little bit in the second debate, but did exceptionally well. Pritzker really looked like a fool, and then they simply wouldn't engage on the abortion issue. And I think they were advised by a campaign manager, an advisor, rather, one of these campaign advisors from D.C., who didn't understand the abortion issue at all, in my estimation.
And certainly didn't understand the climate in Illinois.
Right.
Which is a unique climate because we don't have abortion at issue anymore.
Right.
And in fact, when we did have parental notification, 70% plus of the voters in Illinois were for parental notification.
Right.
And yet he went ahead and signed into law striking down
the law. He repealed parental notice, even though sex trafficking survivors testified begging him not to do it, Michael. So that's something I, you know, would maybe like to touch on as well. But we need to go to our break, so I hope you can stay with us over the break. We'd love to continue our conversation. Listeners, this is Mary Fiorito and Loretta Frelick. We are interviewing Professor Michael New about the new CDC statistics on abortion, and we hope that you'll stay with us. Please don't go away.
Sometimes it's tough to hear winds of change over the air. What with tall buildings, power lines, and other static. Now you can hear Winds of Change anywhere, anytime, or on any device. When Winds of Change is on the air Monday through Friday, noon to 1, go to ststandschurch.org. Scroll down to the Winds of Change tile and click on the Listen Live button, or visit Winds of Change Facebook page to see the Listen Live link.
I'm Mary Fiorito, Winds of Change guest host, and you are listening to the Winds of Change.
St. Stanislaus Koska Academy. St. Stan's is an exceptional private elementary school in Chicago, serving preschool, age 3 and 4, pre-kindergarten, kindergarten, and first grades. We incorporate Catholic values and rigorous academic social-emotional learning, Chinese, Spanish, STEM, and more, providing our students with leadership and life skills to transform our world. St. Stanislaus Koska Academy is conveniently located 1 block north of Division on Noble, just off the Kennedy Expressway. To schedule your tour, visit ststandschicago.org. ststandschicago.org. Here's some good news. We are pleased to announce that St. Stanislaus Koska is open 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, in answer to our Blessed Mother's call to open the doors. The Blessed Sacrament will again be exposed all day, every day, except when masses or other services are being held. You are invited to come and pray anytime, day or night. For your safety, we ask that you practice social distancing and wear a mask. Hand sanitizer is available, and St. Stan's has increased cleaning and sanitizing of the church, and a security person will be on site. More information can be found at ststandschurch.org. That's ststandschurch.org. St. Stanislaus Koska is located 2 blocks north of Division on Noble, just off the Kennedy Expressway.
And welcome back. This is Mary Fiorito and Loretta Fralick here on Winds of Change on AM 750 WNDZ. Thank you for sharing your lunch hour with us. We are joined today by Professor Michael New, who is an expert on the statistics that surround abortion and also particular abortion laws. And Professor New, I know that you recently did a study for the Charlotte Lozier Institute, with whom you're affiliated, on the impact of the Texas Heartbeat Act. So can you tell us a little bit about what you found in your study, but also if you could explain to the listeners what the Texas Heartbeat Act did, what it restricts and what it permits, so that they have an understanding of it before we find out what the act itself, the impact on the people of the state of Texas.
Yes, sir. Even before the Dobbs decision, pro-lifers are making quite a lot of progress passing strong protective pro-life laws. And really one of the first times we really got a good law enforced that really protected a lot of preborn children before viability was the Texas Heartbeat Act. And the Texas Heartbeat Act protected preborn children after a fetal heartbeat could be detected, and that's typically around 6 weeks gestation. And that law took effect on September 1st, 2021. And it had kind of a unique enforcement mechanism. It kind of empowered kind of private actors, private citizens to enforce the law. And that made it very hard for judges to strike down. So unlike other laws that often got struck down by judges, this pro-life law was allowed to take effect. Now, after the Texas Heartbeat Act took effect, abortion numbers in Texas fell. I think in the first month they fell like about 60%. And typically it's a little bit hard to measure how effective pro-life laws are. True, abortion numbers go down, but our opponents would just say, yeah, numbers went down, Michael, but women just got abortions in other states, right, or the laws are more permissive, or they went online and got chemical abortion pills. So I had a pretty good solution to that problem. What I thought I would do is look at birth data from Texas, that based on, how long pregnancies are and, based on, when preborn children in Texas started to be protected, I thought you'd start to see an increase in the Texas birth rate around March 2022, about 7 months after the Texas Heartbeat Act took effect. Okay. That's what I did find. I mean, essentially my argument was that if more women are giving birth, that's, pretty good evidence that the Heartbeat Act is having an effect. If more pregnancies are being carried to term, more children are being protected, that's, again, good evidence that lives are being saved. And that's what I did find. I found that between March 2022 and July 2022, 5,000 more children were born in Texas. So we can be pretty confident that about 5,000 more lives were saved in the first 5 months of the Texas Heartbeat Act alone. So that's a good finding. It's just going to give people some positive reinforcement, that, oftentimes our opponents try to, marginalize or downplay our efforts. But there's a good body of research showing that, pro-life laws, do have an impact. They do protect preborn children. They do spare women from a lifetime of regret. And anytime we can highlight the success of a pro-life law, I think that's a good thing.
And, I love that you focused on the birth statistics and didn't focus on just the abortion rate or the abortion numbers, because that if the birth rate went up by 5,000, that's a significant statistically speaking, that's a pretty significant finding. But it also, I think, speaks to what our opponents are claiming is that women are just going to other states. But I don't think that's necessarily the case.
That's a really important comment, Mary, that they're not going to other states. They are having those children and carrying those children. And what has been used as contraceptive is really, when faced with the other alternative, I can't get one, they carry their baby to term and, oh, look, the birth rate goes up. And what I find really just so egregious is the Schumer's comment where we have to let everybody in from the other countries because our birth rate is not keeping up. Well,
right.
You have had your hand at keeping that birth rate down to the point where it's almost non-existent at some places. And the reason that it's going down is because of all of this ability to obtain an abortion. And here, you show, Professor, that when it's not so easily accessible and the heartbeat laws are protecting the unborn, the birth rate goes up. Maybe you should call Chuck Schumer.
I don't think he'll take my call. It'd be a fun conversation. I'd love to do that.
Yeah. It would serve them well to actually look at the real numbers and then actually You know, the way I've looked at it, because, you know, again, having volunteered at a pregnancy center for 25 years now and talked to so many of the women that we serve, you know, often the case is, not always, but often, where it's the baby's father who's putting the most pressure on her.
Yes.
And when women feel, you know, protected.
Yes.
And that someone is supporting them in their decision to have their child, that they're almost always not going to choose abortion. You see a lot of male, you know, coercion or, you know, male influence in that regard. So I wonder if the Texas law, too, has kind of a protective effect for women.
Yes. And, you know, Mary, that's an important comment that you make, because you and I have often talked that, you know, it would not be what our families would have chosen for us. But had we presented with an unplanned, unmarried pregnancy, our families may not have liked it, but they sure would have rallied around us.
Right.
And would have given us the protection and the care and all the love that we needed. And I think so many times when these women are presenting at pregnancy resource centers like Aid for Women, they have no one to wrap their arms around them.
Right.
And, you know, for so long, the pro-choice movement or pro-abortion movement has been saying, you know, you don't care about the mother and the baby. And yet, if you take a deep, hard look at pro-life movement, you see these pregnancy resource centers, which we've talked on other shows, have become the very point of their attack,
mm-hmm.
you know, with graffiti and bombings and all kinds of hateful action. These are the places that are fully caring for the woman and her child.
Yeah.
And when that woman is, like you said, safe, protected, nurtured, you know, taught the life skills you need to raise a child,
right,
then they blossom. They have such a beautiful, loving relationship with their child, and they are able to meet life head on.
Yeah. Michael, have you kept any tabs or studied the different states that provide either support to pregnancy centers or the state of Illinois doesn't by any means, but I know that there are some states where through particular state programs, pregnancy centers are sometimes able to access funding or grant monies to be able to help the women that they serve. Have you followed the Texas legislators' efforts to increase? I think they've put $100 million into the Texas program that supports, you know, different organizations in the state that assist pregnant women. Has any of your research focused on that particular aspect?
I mean, it is true. I mean, there are many states that are doing things to help pregnancy help centers. And I think it's great that instead of supporting groups like Planned Parenthood that destroy life, they're supporting these pregnancy help centers that are life-affirming. And you are right that Texas state legislature did allocate around $100 million to their alternatives to abortion program that does help local pregnancy centers in Texas. You know, we don't really have a lot of, at least I have not conducted research on this yet. Maybe I will, and you'll have me as a guest on a future show to discuss my findings.
I think that would be very valuable research, frankly, because it's to see how it's impacting mothers. You know, one of the interesting things, you and I have talked about this before, Michael, is, you know, this turnaway study that abortion advocates are always throwing around. And what never or very rarely gets mentioned is that after 5 years, you know, the 1,000 women that were in this turnaway study, 96% of them said they were glad that they couldn't get the abortion they wanted to have.
Wow.
96%. And so, you know, you never hear that particular one. And yes, was the first year after they had their child difficult. Sure it was, because
having a child is difficult.
Right, exactly. Welcome to the world. But, you know, but also what it indicates is that, you know, the issues, you know, with the baby's father or with her job or with school or whatever the problem is doesn't go away if you have the baby, and it doesn't go away if you have the abortion.
Right.
It's the problem is the problem. And that's, you know, what I think that speaks to is that it's, you know, abortion's a permanent solution to a temporary problem, because then when you talk to the same women 5 years later, the problem's gone. So therefore, the child is wanted. And, you know, Michael, I know one of the things I would love if you could touch on, I know you and a very dedicated group of your friends are present at Planned Parenthood clinic in D.C. every Saturday morning. Can you talk about any of the, you know, experiences that you've had, and how does that, you know, impact, or how is that reflected in this really careful statistical research that you do?
Well, I often joke I have one of the best jobs in the pro-life movement. I get to do research, I get to write, I get to be on great radio shows like this, and it's fun, pleasant, rewarding work that I enjoy. But a lot of pro-life work, in my opinion, isn't always fun or pleasant or rewarding day-to-day. You know, I think
right.
that the most important pro-life work very often does not make the front page of the paper.
Right.
So I moved to the Washington, D.C. area to start a faculty position at Catholic University in August of 2018. And after being settled in, one Saturday, I decided to head to the Planned Parenthood and just see what's happening there. And I've been to D.C. previously, and we always had a very strong, you know, sidewalk constant presence at the D.C. Planned Parenthood.
Right.
So when I showed up that Saturday, I was very surprised. We only have, like, two pro-life people there.
Yeah.
And I was just amazed. Like, where'd everybody go? And there was a new location,
right.
and some people moved away, and just circumstantially, some people weren't coming. And I thought, you know what? I just felt really called to get this built back up again. So
right.
I went on social media and told my friends, maybe the Planned Parenthood Saturday at 9, please join me. The world didn't exactly bang down my door, but I kept coming consistently, and I built up a mailing list, and friends of mine started coming, and we're in a much better position now than we were 4 years ago. So,
right.
you know, I think, again, there's great pro-life ministries and activities, but as I always tell my friends, there really is no better way to build a culture of life than being a prayerful presence where abortions take place. So,
right.
you know, we've done 40 Days for Life and, you know, do rallies to get people to come out and pray. And, you know, again, it's not always easy. You know, you don't always see, you know, positive things happen in front of you every
right.
day. But, you know, anyone who's been out there for any extended period of time can at least point to one story where an abortion did not happen, simply because they showed up and came to that abortion clinic and prayed that day.
Yeah.
You know, Mike, I also have found that some of the most peaceful times in my relationship with God has been on the picket line in front of the abortuaries. And with, you know, the pro, you know, aborts screaming in my face and spitting at me. And yet the peace of God that comes down on you when you are willing to war for his babies. I can't explain it, but it's so amazing.
Yeah. Michael, how far into pregnancy does a Planned Parenthood clinic there perform abortions?
I think my understanding around 22 weeks gestation, I may be slightly off on that. It doesn't do the very late term
right.
Abortions, but you know it does them fairly far along.
Okay, because there's another clinic in D.C. that's become sort of notorious because of the remains of the five children that were found in the garbage
right.
by some other activists from a kind of a secular, agnostic, atheist pro-life group, interestingly enough. And I know it's always, and I think, unfortunately, Justice Sotomayor's line of questioning at the oral arguments for the Dobbs decision, you know, of course, trying to press this as a religious issue, that abortion is a religious issue, and these are religious things. And so it's so wonderful when our atheist and agnostic pro-life friends show up, you know, to do their peaceful protesting and prayer, presence, I guess. So good vibes presence. But do you know anything more about those five babies that were found there? Could you speak to that at all?
Sure. Actually, I know that the women who found them, one is Teresa Bukovnik, who runs a progressive anti-abortion uprising.
Right.
She joins me on the sidewalk at the Planned Parenthood. And another is Lauren Handy, who's kind of a full-time pro-life missionary. Right now, Lauren is involved with Red Rose Rescue. She's actually serving a jail sentence in Flint,
right.
Michigan, because she was involved in some civil disobedience at an abortion facility there. So please pray for Lauren, she's a tremendous presence
still
on the sidewalk.
Yeah, I didn't realize she's still incarcerated.
What's Lauren's last name? I'm sorry.
Her name is Lauren Handy, H-A-N-D-Y.
Okay. And so what happened when they found these children?
They basically got the children. There was a delivery truck, and they simply asked the driver if they could have all the boxes, and the delivery driver, for some very odd reason, let them have
yeah.
one of the boxes, and it contained the remains of the aborted children.
Mm.
And, you know, it was obviously very, you know, challenging, you know, for them, you know, kind of emotionally. They did get a priest, I think, to kind of bless the
right.
children. that they actually were not quite sure what to do with the remains. They, you know, took photos that were professional to kind of document what happened. They reached out to some other pro-life people for advice. We had kind of a mass where we actually named the children, both the five that were kind of more fully developed, and I think the over 150 that were kind of in earlier stage of gestation. So, and then, you know, the 150 was given to a priest who did bury them. So those children did get the proper burial. And I think they decided potentially that, you know, the remains need to be handed over to proper law enforcement authorities. And you know, the D.C. police were notified, and the remains are taken. And right now, our understanding is they're still in storage. We're lobbying to get a proper autopsy. You know, we have not given up on that. You know, obviously things are moving slowly, but our plan is that we'd like to get to see, you know, how these children, you know, did in fact die. You know, was it a partial birth abortion, you know, which would have been a violation of federal law.
Right.
So it's still ongoing. It's not getting much attention now, and we are hoping with the Republicans taking control of Congress, maybe there'll be a hearing on this. Maybe that might push something, but it's still an issue that, you know, the activists in D.C. are working on, and, you know, when things happen, I'll keep you updated.
Oh, we would greatly appreciate that. And we're going to go to our final break, Michael. I hope you can stay with us over for the last couple minutes of the show, because we'd love to just, you know, pick your brain about a couple of other things. You are such a wealth of information, and you really keep your finger on the pulse. So.
And you make statistics fun.
That's right. A class I managed to successfully avoid in college because I was told it was too hard for people like me. So that's why I became a lawyer instead. So listeners, we are with Professor Michael New, the human computer, as I like to call him. So please don't go away. This is Mary Fiorito and Loretta Fralick sitting in for Father Anthony today on Winds of Change on AM 750 WNDZ.
St. Stanislaus Koska Academy. St. Stan's is an exceptional private elementary school in Chicago, serving preschool, age 3 and 4, pre-kindergarten, kindergarten, and first grades. We incorporate Catholic values and rigorous academic social-emotional learning, Chinese, Spanish, STEM, and more, providing our students with leadership and life skills to transform our world. St. Stanislaus Koska Academy is conveniently located one block north of Division on Noble, just off the Kennedy Expressway. To schedule your tour, visit ststanschicago.org. ststanschicago.org. Here is an open letter from Father Anthony Bush. Thank you, thank you, thank you. You people are the best of the best. I do not have the words that can adequately convey to you my gratitude for your amazing support to the renovation project that foresees new restrooms and the basement renovation that will enable us to have a gathering space after Mass for meetings and other events. A million thanks to some members of the Finance Council who have put in thousands of hours working at many levels of the project with contractors, archdiocesan personnel, and others. May God reward all of you for your amazing generosity. Signed, Pastor Anthony Bush.
I'm Loretta Fralick, Winds of Change guest host, and you are listening to the Winds of Change.
Here's some good news. We are pleased to announce that St. Stanislaus Koska is open 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, in answer to our Blessed Mother's call to open the doors. The Blessed Sacrament will again be exposed all day, every day, except when Masses or other services are being held. You are invited to come and pray anytime, day or night. For your safety, we ask that you practice social distancing and wear a mask. Hand sanitizer is available, and St. Stan's has increased cleaning and sanitizing of the church, and a security person will be on site. More information can be found at ststanschurch.org. That's ststanschurch.org. St. Stanislaus Koska is located two blocks north of Division on Noble, just off the Kennedy Expressway.
And welcome back. We're in our final segment now. This hour has flown, as it always does, when we are with our guest, Professor Michael New, who is an expert on abortion statistics, specifically, but also statistics kind of generally. And Professor New, we've talked about the new CDC, the 2020 CDC abortion data, And we've talked about the midterms. And so we've kind of had a sweeping conversation about, you know, some very broad aspects of abortion data. What would you say would be that kind of the key takeaways from both the midterms and this new CDC information that you've written on?
I mean, as far as the midterms go, you know, again, there were some setbacks. You know, I mean, I think that, you know, pro-lifers, we didn't really do as well as we would have liked on those state-level ballot propositions. Unfortunately, we know that money plays a big role in kind of who wins and who loses, and we were outspent. And sadly, in a lot of states, a lot of that money came from out of state, which is frustrating.
Right.
But we need to, you know, we need to overcome the challenges. I mean, one thing pro-lifers have always done well is we've always overcome all kinds of challenges since 1973.
Yep.
You know, we had challenges getting even incremental pro-life laws upheld.
Right.
Even getting the Hyde Amendment upheld was not easy. The Supreme Court upheld that in 1980 by like a single vote. You know, getting parental involvement laws upheld was a challenge. Getting good judges out of Republican presidential nominees was a challenge.
Right.
Getting Republican senators to block Democrat nominees was a challenge. We overcome all of this. So
right.
These are ballot propositions. It's a new challenge, but, you know, we can't run from it. We got to stand up to it and engage it, and I think we can overcome this one as well. So, you know, there's that. And just the one thing I would just say, both the CDC data and the elections, you know, one thing I always tell pro-lifers is that we never promised, you know, a smooth glide path to victory. You know, there's going to be setbacks, disappointments, and aggravations along the way. And, you know, the reversal of Roe v. Wade was a huge victory, but it's not the end. You know, I'm out of the famous, you know, Winston Churchill quote, it's not the end, it's not the beginning of the end, but it might well be the end of the beginning.
Right,
so,
right.
You know, we have made progress, you know, we have a ways to go. We just need to keep doing our pro-life work, whether it's education, service, legislation, prayer. You know, it all adds up. I mean, you know, there's lots of great ways to build a culture of life. It needs to be kind of a full spectrum approach. It's not any one thing. It's everything.
Okay.
Can I ask you, Mike, where were you when you learned the decision came down in Dobbs?
I was actually on a subway hitting the Supreme Court. I wish I'd actually been right there at the court. But I almost didn't go that day because I really didn't think it was going to come down. I thought it'd be the last day.
Right.
And I didn't have to be decisions next week. So I almost didn't go, but, you know, I do like friends there. So I thought, Michael, well, if nothing else, just go and support your friends. And
right.
Then I see kind of my Twitter lights up and, you know, Dobbs is reversed and, you know, or Roe is reversed, I should say.
Right.
And 10 minutes later, I'm at the court and my friends are all cheering and celebrating. And
right.
Students selected a rally. I got to speak at the rally. I got to jump on the podium and talk for a couple
Michael,
minutes to the crowd of people.
Yeah, what a moment to remember. You know, we have I keep likening it to the Cubs winning the World Series. You know, not because it was, you know, impossible, but just because of the sort of inevitability of it. You know, my husband had the best analogy. He said it's like that game Jenga, and somebody just pulled out the right block in the middle of the stack, and it all, you know, it was almost kind of bewildering when it happened. You know, just because we've just seen so many decisions go sideways. Planned Parenthood versus Casey being one of them. So, Michael, talk a little bit about your ongoing work now. What's going to be your next study or focus for you?
I mean, I was kind of several things in the hopper. One thing I'm really interested in is, again, birth data, but looking at other states. You know, I think the next thing I look at is Oklahoma. You know, they had a heartbeat law that took effect around May of 2022.
Right.
And then with the Dobbs decision, you know, that obviously came down in, you know, late June, you know, in about, you know, 7, 8, 9 months. You know, we'll have some good birth data from those states that did protect preborn children. So I think really tracking birth data is really a good strategy for us because I think it really does nicely document that these pro-life laws are saving lives and having an impact. So that's going to be my focus in the kind of the near future.
Yeah, it's that's Michael. We're so grateful for your work because it's so important to have really good, firm data that we can use, not because we want to manipulate anything, but because people need to know the truth. I think that so many, it's kind of a paraphrase of Fulton Sheen's, you know, people don't really hate Catholicism. They hate what they think Catholicism is, which tend to be two different things. And, you know, I participated at a forum at Notre Dame's law school last week that I thought was going to be a lecture, and it turned out to be sort of a debate. And I was caught very much off guard. And so you know, I talked about the Doe versus Bolton decision and tried to explain how the United States was one of only seven countries until Dobbs that permitted abortion up until the moment of birth. And the pro-abortion attorney sitting next to me just said, no, there's only a couple of states where it's allowed. And she's wrong about that. And abortion was never that, you know, whatever.
Personally, I would never want to be in a debate where Mary was my opponent, but...
Yeah. Well, you know what? But it was me against five people. So it was not... Anyway, and that may have been that the students were just, you know, just unprepared and didn't really understand, you know, the implications of having, you know, kind of a lopsided viewpoint. At least I'll give them the benefit of the doubt and, you know, and attribute to ignorance and not to malice, but still. Michael, do you do much, you know, I don't think people actually do debates anymore. At least on the one hand, you got people of differing viewpoints and to hear... to hear what the pro-life perspective was. I mean, the first speaker, what really took me aback was that the first speaker just talked about how this was a completely religious issue. And I'm just surprised that educated people would even say that because it's so false on its face. Michael, what's the most absurd argument that you've been presented with in all the time?
The most absurd argument? That's a really good question. I'm not sure I have a good answer.
Because
I mean, the one argument that often comes up that I think really is absurd is this bodily autonomy. It may make sense, but we really, I mean, there's all kinds of ways we just don't grant people bodily autonomy. I mean, there's drugs you can't take. You can't snort cocaine. You can't engage in prostitution. You know, there's all kinds of things we just don't let fellow human beings do because they undermine human dignity. And, you know, abortion certainly falls under that. So I've always found that to be a very weak argument put forth by the other side.
Yes, and try and drive drunk in the United States anymore. Well, 25 years ago, it may have been something that was rampant, but now it is so curtailed by the law, and and we've changed the social understanding of the importance of driving sober.
And Loretta, I know that you know you something has been on your heart. Speaking of unjust legal systems and unjust persecutions of people, but the situation with Cardinal Zen, can you please?
90-year-old Cardinal Zen has been found guilty of having a humanitarian fund, which in Hong Kong resulted in this man being fined 4,000 Hong Kong dollars, which amount to $512 in the United States.
Okay.
I would pay his fine if I had an access.
Right.
But, you know, he came out on Friday and said, you know, I know in the West they're looking at this as kind of a crackdown on religious freedom. This is not about religious freedom. Well, and that was a statement. So, hello, America.
Yeah.
This can come to your neighborhood. Can you imagine? He and five other people, one of whom was a pop star, they had $1 million fund for the protesters to pay their legal fees, to pay their fines, to pay for audio equipment, you know, microphones. And the Chinese government Beijing decided to crack down through Hong Kong's courts and found these five people guilty. But what I find is so reprehensible is this holy man has been an outspoken critic for the faithful in Hong Kong, and yet they chose to come after him.
It's just astounding to me. And Michael, you know, at some point, have you, I'd love to have you on to talk about abortion in China. Have you followed those numbers at all?
I'm not an expert on the whole forced abortion policy in China. I mean, I have kind of followed international data and, you know, can talk about how Poland, which has some very good pro-life laws, also has very strong public health metrics. I think they have among the lowest, if not the lowest, maternal mortality rate in Europe. Mm-hmm. So I have read kind of the European statistics, but I've not really followed China that closely.
Right. Well, you know, we were speaking of the maternity home and pregnancy center where Loretta and I have volunteered, and we actually had a woman who got on a plane and flew to Chicago's O'Hare Airport. And because she had her first child, they had a second child, she and her husband, that they couldn't, because it was still the one-child policy, didn't register with the government. And now she was pregnant with a third child, who was a girl. So she got on a plane and wound up staying, long story short, stayed with us for 3 years, got asylum, and is now living in Texas. And her husband and children are here with her, and they've just had a fourth baby.
But praise God.
But the story she told us would set your hair on edge. But we can maybe talk about that the next time you join us, which I hope you will. Professor New, always a joy to be with you and to just tap into all of that knowledge of yours. And listeners, you can follow Professor Michael New's blog at National Review. Anything specific, Professor New, they should look for?
You can follow me on Twitter at Michael_J_New. That's a good way to keep up with me. And thanks everyone for listening.
Oh, well, fantastic. Thank you again. It's been a joy for us. And listeners, a joy to be with you as ever. And we will see you next week.
Thank you. See you next week.
The winds have changed. Marvel and flatter such meaningless thought. The shell appears strong, but the inside is wrought. It's time to be stirred. The time is